Happy Independence Day to everybody out there.
It's good to be with you.
It's the name of the program is In Context, WPKN's live public affairs show. And we were going to talk about two different subjects tonight. We'd like to look at the recent Republican presidential debate, which took place in New Hampshire in June, hosted by CNN. And we also want to talk about some recent a recent report by the World Health Organization on a possible connection between cancer and cell phone use, which apparently is particularly dangerous for children.
Mm-hmm.
But first, the Republican debate took place June 13th at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire, which hosts a very important early primary. And there were seven Republican candidates. I'll just mention them in no particular order of preference. Rick Santorum, who's a former senator from Pennsylvania, Michelle Bachmann, who is a congressman from Minnesota, Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House, Mitt Romney, the former Massachusetts governor, Ron Paul, the veteran Texas congressman, and Tom Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota, and number seven I have here is Herman Cain, who was a businessman, the founder of Godfather's Pizza. Now, I know, Gus, you listened to the debate carefully. What was your assessment of the candidates, of the whole debate process?
Well, interestingly, you mentioned Herman Cain, who is advertised as the founder of Godfather's Pizza, but I know him more as the former chairman and member of the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank in Kansas City.
Is that right?
Yeah, and that would probably let you know more about where he's coming from rather than starting a pizza chain, because you know when he's on these when he's making speeches, when he's in these debates, you know, he's talking about being a businessman,
right,
and how to solve problems from a business orientation, but. You know, he's really coming at it from a big business banker point of view.
And you mentioned that the Federal Reserve, there was only one candidate who mentioned the Federal Reserve during the debate, and he mentions it consistently in his speeches, and that's Congressman Ron Paul.
Right.
What troubles him about the Federal Reserve?
Well, you know, we've covered it before in this show, and it's a real staple to Ron Paul's podium. You know, the soapbox that he's always on is getting out from under the thumb of the private Federal Reserve, you know, who is a private run-for-profit bank that has shareholders, and it serves at the pleasure of the big banks. And, you know, they will stop at nothing to inflate the currency to the point of no return to make sure that the plutocrats that run this country and the world keep the profits in their pocket and keep the working man from ever being able to gain any headway.
And inflation really does rob the average guy.
Right.
I've read that
he calls it a hidden tax, Ron Paul does.
Since the founding of the Federal Reserve in 1913, the dollar has lost 95% of its value.
Right. And that's a startling figure because you don't have to live 100 years in order to feel that. You just have to live 60 years, you know, to the point of retirement when you lose 600% of all the money that you've earned over your life.
It's a significant problem for the average person. And the part of the problem with the Federal Reserve is that, and it's not one I don't think he dwells on, which is the fact that we pay interest for money that we the people could issue for free.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why I think you have inflation is you always have to create more money in order to have enough money to pay the interest on the money you could have created debt free.
Yeah, and you could be private or instead of what we have now where we privatize the losses, or what is it now? Socialize the losses and privatize the profits.
It's a great system.
We would make it turn it the other way around so that we would nationalize the profits of the banks and then take that money right around and build infrastructure and provide free education or health care for the citizenry.
Now, the Federal Reserve is one of the key issues. He's the only one that talks about it. And talked about in this debate,
right.
I think on the Democratic side, the only one talked about is Dennis Kucinich. Mm-hmm. What did the other Republican candidates talk about?
Well, the other candidates, I took some quick talking points on each of these candidates. And one of the darlings of the Tea Party is Michelle Bachmann. She's the caucus chair And one of the big things that she stands for is being pro-life. Now, you know, I tend to agree. I think life is precious. I don't think that we should be terminating these lives, especially when it's so hard to adopt children in this country. You know, we should make the creation of life something that's precious. We should give some gratitude toward mothers who are willing to give up their children for adoption should they wish to do so. You know, Michelle Bachmann makes a big point of saying that she's adopted a bunch of kids and she's fostered a bunch of kids. But, and you know, and while I agree with the pro-life stance, she is also pro-war.
Yes.
And that's not something that I can come to terms with, because if life is precious, life is precious. End of sentence.
Yes.
And you can't have a pro-war and pro-life stance. I just don't see how those things jive.
It seems more it's just political expedience, and that if you're a Republican running for the nomination, you've got to be very strongly opposed to abortion. And then once you get the nomination, or maybe you get elected in a more liberal area, you start to move towards a more wishy-washy position on abortion.
Yeah. And she also, in terms of the war, she basically thinks that the USA should be an imperialist force.
Yes.
You know, she doesn't go right ahead and say that the USA should be an empire, but she does seem like she pretty strongly thinks that the USA should be the world leader. And that's not something I agree with. I don't think that the United States has any responsibility to be the leader of the world at all. You know, we can set a precedent or be a role model for a free republic, but I don't think that we should be going around telling people how to live their lives and take it upon ourselves to intervene when we think it's necessary.
Well, of course, we're not doing these wars for the benefit of the people, the countries we're invading.
No.
It's about, as we discussed, as we've researched in discussing groups like the Bilderberg, and we're going to be talking about them in detail on our show on Wednesday. The whole imperialist war goes back to the origins of oil, really, at the turn of the century. And it's all about, from whether it's the British or the Americans, about gaining control of where the oil's pumped out of the ground and the key transit routes for oil.
Yeah, and she did mention something I was pleased with, that Al-Qaeda is within the ranks of the rebels in Libya. And, you know, obviously they are from the Wahhabist sect, and they are, you know, a lot more extreme in terms of religion and their oppressive views in contrast to Gaddafi. And it just kind of seems like she's latching on to this talking point, but not really grasping the overall point of the Libyan intervention. She thinks that she made fun of the fact that Obama deferred to France in leading the NATO attacks. Now, I don't think that France should be leading anybody in these attacks. I think she's missing the point. There should be no NATO involvement at all.
Right.
It shouldn't be a debate of who's leading the attacks. It should be a debate of whether the attacks should even be taking place.
Well, they don't seem to have any grasp or any real interest in foreign policy. It seems as you listen to these guys, mm-hmm. they have a very superficial understanding of both foreign and domestic policy, and they repeat these talking points, with the exception of Ron Paul. Especially on the issue of how to revive the economy. They say we must deregulate business.
Yeah.
Right? We have to
lower. They don't really know what that means.
They don't know what
though.
That means. We have to cut spending.
They don't know what that means.
And we have to lower taxes on higher income individuals. Well, this morning's New York Times reported that the 200 CEOs in the 200 largest corporations had an income increase last year of 23%.
Mm-hmm.
That's in
that's
one
comfortable.
Year. That's pretty nice, right? Meanwhile, we have unemployment, which is probably really like 15-16%.
And many, in some states, it's at least 22-23%.
And many people are having their wages cut. They're forced mm-hmm. to work longer hours.
Underemployed.
And many people are underemployed. And so the last thing we really need is more tax cuts for the rich. But I think that in a way, as I listen to these guys.
But define rich, though. That's something that's been misrepresented, though. You know, what do you define as rich?
I think that the people who, let's say their net worth is more than $10, $20, $30 million, they're the ones really in control. And I think they look at everybody else, whether you're making $10 an hour or $150,000 a year, I think they look at the rest of us as ants.
Right.
That's what I think.
Well, you're either in the club or you're not.
And most of us, and even if you're making $150,000, $200,000, you're not in the club. I mean, after all, if you got three kids in college, you're going to be wiped out by that. that $200,000 is nothing.
Exactly. You know, to be able to pay for that in cash and not have to take a loan.
So the middle class in America has a bullseye on its forehead. And these guys all, I think probably with the exception of Ron Paul, all are pandering to them as if they're going to help them. When in fact, they've just been exacerbating policies which are transferring wealth more and more every year to a very, very small part of our country. And I think that that's a bad idea. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you don't want all the wealth and political power in your country concentrated in the hands of the top one-tenth of 1%.
No, of course. That's never a good thing. Moving on, some of the other candidates that are I didn't really know much about before looking into them. And I still, even after looking into them, can't really say too much about them. And those two guys are Governor Tim Pawlenty and Rick Santorum,
right?
Because they come off looking so weak. I think
yeah.
They don't really seem like they stand for anything in particular, except for, you know, buzzwords like,
that's right,
I'm for the Constitution. Okay,
right.
Well, I hope we're all for the Constitution. You know, you're not going to get elected by getting up there saying the Constitution is a bad document.
Right.
You know, and I think that Pawlenty came off looking very weak, especially because he refused to confront Mitt Romney on his Obamacare statement.
Which was, now, Romney has introduced, when he was governor of Massachusetts, a universal care health care program.
Universal health care.
Okay, and how does that square with the almost universal disgust of the Republicans with Obama's health care program? In fact, they almost all of them said they would repeal it.
They did, and even Romney himself, I don't know if he didn't quite write, but was a strong proponent of universal health care in Massachusetts, something that's popular. Everyone likes the idea, but it's very hard to come to terms with how to make it work.
Yeah.
You know, and whether I think that it was a step towards socialized medicine or not doesn't really matter, because it was done under the state's jurisdiction. So
yeah.
It was done the right way.
Yeah.
So I may not particularly agree with the way that he was forcing people to purchase something and picking a winner in the market by giving subsidies or mandates, you know, that type of thing, which really irks me. But it was still done in the state's borders. And if another state doesn't like it, they can learn from that mistake if it fails.
Yeah, yes, yes.
And that's what it needs to be done on,
you
not
think
federally.
That decentralization would be
that's
a
really
good
the
idea.
Key. And even though I dislike Mitt Romney, he did make a good point in saying, look, it's our state's responsibility to do this. We did it. It seems to be working for them so far. You know, I think that it is probably a disproportionate burden on the middle class as usual. But it's definitely not as bad as what Obama came up with, giving out waivers to all the major corporations and big donors.
Obama's healthcare program is really easy to throw rocks at.
Oh, yeah.
He comes up with this idea of essentially trying to expand coverage by expanding Medicaid, and without any real way to finance it other than by cutting Medicare.
Yeah.
And the real problem is the control of the private insurance companies, control of the healthcare system, and the huge influence of the large medical care providers.
Well, the healthcare companies,
nothing about
the healthcare companies, the insurance companies wrote that bill.
Right, right.
They did. It just favors them disproportionately. It forces people to buy their product, and it allows them to keep the cost high. It does nothing to reduce the cost in any direction, anywhere.
No, well, there's no, you know, I remember at a debate, I think it was 8 years ago, when Congressman Kucinich was sitting on a Larry King show with the other candidates and said, guys, we all know the problem. The problem is every time we talk about reforming the healthcare system at our convention, the insurance companies veto it.
Mm.
So why can't we get this through? And then Larry King, which I thought was a great testament to our TV news, asked one of the other candidates how his wife felt about campaigning.
Oh, my goodness. What a great follow-up question.
Larry King has always been a legend for the level of discussion. What did you think about the overall way the debate was handled?
You know, I didn't really like it. I felt like a lot of time was wasted on unimportant stuff. But then when, like, for example, the this or that sequence of questioning, you know, and asking Ron Paul, does he prefer BlackBerry or iPhone?
Yeah,
Ron Paul seeming so uncomfortable with how stupid the question was, just because BlackBerry.
For those of you who didn't see the debate, it was beyond belief that John King,
so
the host, was asking the candidates incredibly trivial questions, and I think his justifications with this was going to humanize the candidate.
Yeah, make us know them more personally. Right.
So do you like Elvis better or Johnny Cash? Bachman was asked.
And she was like actually perplexed by the question. It was like, oh my goodness, that's such a good question. I don't know how to answer that. Oh, they're both so amazing.
Well, it's set up in a way with 60-second answers and 30-second follow-ups that how can you possibly say anything meaningful about something as complicated as healthcare in 60 seconds?
I don't know. I mean, I felt like there just wasn't enough time to flesh out the answers. I think that a better, you know, there wasn't enough time, but then again, they had to take time out for this or that, you know.
That's
so
right.
So there's not enough time, and he kept on going, yeah, whenever people were trying to get deep into the answer to hurry them up, because they were only allowed 30
that's
seconds.
That's right, guaranteed superficial
but then,
responses.
You know, barbecue wings, hot or mild. You know, let's hurry up and get to the important stuff.
Well, my sense is that it looks really good for re-election right now, because the consensus amongst these guys seems to be that what we need to do is cut taxes on the rich, and we should cut Social Security and cut Medicare. And I don't think that any Republican's going to get elected on a platform like that. It's just, to me, they're almost handing him the election. And I bet the big money will continue to flow to Obama like it did. He says he wants to raise $1 billion in this campaign.
Oh, boy.
I think he raised about $700 million in the last. And anybody thinks that Obama was getting those money from Boy Scouts, think again. I mean, they're coming from the usual heavy hitters. And when he got elected, and I was covering the campaign here at PKN on election night, a lot of people were very excited and looking forward to big changes. And I said, look at all the money this guy's getting from the big shots. I said, if he does anything really different, I'd be real surprised. And what did we get out of Obama? An escalation of Bush's war,
yeah,
and a nothing health care program that's not going to do anything but further enrich the insurance companies.
No, exactly. And I just want to get to a few of the other candidates, too,
sure.
Because it's quite important to talk about two people in particular, Newt Gingrich, and a little bit more about Mitt Romney. And I'd also like to mention Rick Perry, who hasn't entered the fray yet, but there's a lot of talk about him doing so. Just to run along some of the highlights of Newt Gingrich, I don't see how he has the guts to come out of hibernation to run for office again, especially as a Republican.
That's amazing.
He's a guy who, he talks big about the Constitution, and this is why I wish that the debates were set up differently, so that they could have more of a back and forth. I think they should really just pick a few key issues and really let the candidates show their cards.
That's right.
Because you have a guy like Newt Gingrich, who's really a globalist. He was called by Lou Rockwell a Rockefeller Republican, you know, and he supported Nelson Rockefeller for governor of New York in 1968. He's an academic. He was a professor. Gingrich was. He voted for the savings and loan bailouts in 91. He voted to give hundreds of billions to expand the size of the federal government in the mid-90s. He talked big about the national debt ceiling while in Congress, but voted to increase it anyway. He consistently voted in favor of billions of dollars in foreign aid, voted to lock up the Alaskan wilderness, which was really about creating artificial domestic oil scarcity. He voted to bring the EPA up to cabinet level, voted to federalize education by creating the Department of Education, which anybody who hears that on its face thinks, well, the Department of Education, how could you be against that? How could you be against the Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency? Except any of these things on a federal level works completely against what it stands to. You know, if you federalize education, you're taking away the power to produce new innovative education methods from the state level. You know, in the state, that's where you have the ability to affect change locally.
Right.
And that's where you should be able to create your curriculum for education, not at the Department of Education, which standardizes everything across the country and creates one uniformly low bar that everybody fails.
So this kind of conservative rhetoric is actually phony. You would call it conservatism.
Oh, he's totally a phony, yeah. And he's the biggest things. He supported NAFTA, GATT, and the World Trade Organization in the mid-90s. And all of those have contributed to the death of the United States economy.
Sure. And this shows that we really have a one-party system.
Yes.
Because that was pushed through by Clinton.
Yeah, he was also the minority whip at the time. So he had the chance during a lame duck session to postpone the vote for GATT. And he refused to do so. And he went on to say that this was going to be a boon, you know. And who was it? I forget who it was. But he said that NAFTA and GATT was the second and third leg toward the New World Order.
Well, Ross Perot ran heavily against NAFTA in 92,
yeah.
And so did Jerry Brown on the Democratic side.
Oh, it was
and
Henry Kissinger who said that. He wrote that NAFTA and GATT was going to be instrumental in bringing about the New World Order.
And of course, yeah, it's really the global agenda, it sounds kind of good in a way. Oh, we're going to have one world government and we'll have peace, but really really, it's just about corporate control. It's about consolidating all power, centralizing all power in large private corporations, and particularly large international
rule
banks.
By the elite.
That's it.
Right?
That's it.
That's all it comes down to. And then Mitt Romney, he said in an interview that when he was asked about whether we should audit the Federal Reserve, you know, as Ron Paul has been campaigning to get.
Right.
He said, quote, "I'm not going to focus on the Fed." He's not interested in the activities. In the 2008 debate, he was asked by Chris Matthews if the president, quote unquote, needs congressional approval to launch an attack against Iran. And he said he would ask his attorneys.
I see.
Okay. The question was, do you need congressional approval as president? And he said, I'll ask my attorneys.
It's not too impressive. And yet he's generally regarded. He's generally regarded as the man to beat. He seems to have the
most
money.
Understand why, but I think it's just because, you know, someone I know has told me, he looks presidential. He sounds presidential. He's got the deep voice, the resonant tone. He's tall. He's got the sandy dark hair.
He's got it. But, you know, he ran last time and he had more money than anybody else and he didn't catch on.
He's a big business guy.
Yeah, definitely.
He is for the banks. He's for the insurance company. He's for the big business.
But guess who else is? The president of the United States.
Yeah.
So, folks,
he's perfect presidential material.
I go back to Kang and Kodos, for those of you who are Simpsons. That's a no-win situation. But which I like, and we often speak sympathetically of Ron Paul, and I would say Dennis Kucinich, because
yes.
There are a couple populists out there, and they're usually marginalized. In fact, they're always marginalized. But this time around, it seems like Ron Paul's getting a little bit more play. They're treating him as a more serious candidate, which he should be because he comes out top in the polls. What's your analysis of that?
Well, my analysis of that is that it's really about time. You know, he's somebody who's a real populist. He really is for the little guy. In fact, you know, it's sort of a cliche, but you know, he's the only guy who doesn't get the big business donors going
right.
through to his campaign. And, you know, I think that's why it's so important to
he offers us a choice.
Yeah. I mean,
I
read his books, you know, his last two books, and he's got a new one out now called Liberty Defined. And it's 30 essays on pivotal issues, you know, everything in alphabetical order from abortion to torture and things like that. And what the Constitution has to say about it and what states' rights are involved there. And which one of those things should be a states' rights issue? You know,
and these are the guys Ron Paul should be commanding the platform with, along with people like Dennis Kucinich, who
yes.
will be coming from a different perspective, but also speaking on populist issues.
Yeah, let them bring their opinion to the party.
Right. Instead of this corporate dialogue, this phony corporate dialogue.
Yeah, because, I mean, these stupid debates, they're stupid, right?
Right.
They really are. They're below par.
They're not Lincoln Douglas, where men would stand up for hours in front of a live crowd, thousands of people, and they would have to defend their positions in great detail.
Right. And no, this is bite-sized. This is like the kind of information you get from a Snapple cap.
That's the Snapple cap version of politics.
It's so stupid. I mean, and Mitt Romney is a guy who's changed his opinion so many times. Like I just said, he needed congressional approval to decide whether he was going to launch an attack on Iran. And then Ron Paul laid into him and said he should read the Constitution for the answer. you know, last month, he told a New Hampshire crowd that that man is responsible for global warming, but on his website, he says that the Earth's climate changes all the time, and he's skeptical about man-made global warming. All right, so he's got both sides of the issue there. His website says he's against cap and trade, but as governor, he supported a carbon trading pact between states in the Northeast. He later changed course, saying the cap and trade would disproportionately hurt American businesses, and he insisted that only a global cap and trade system would work. So he's, how do you have both ways? You can say, yeah, I support cap and trade, but then after it gets passed, you say, oh, but it's going to hurt us, so maybe we need to do this globally.
Well, another science issue which connects to the big influence of big business is the cell phone and cancer issue. Because here we've got all these billions of dollars being made in cell phones, and the World Health Organization comes out and says, hey, cell phones could cause cancer. And it comes on the heels of a 2008 Swedish study, which said that they expected a fivefold increase in cancers amongst children who are users of cell phones. So we have all of this evidence, or continually mounting evidence, and yet what does the National Cancer Institute say about cell phones?
Well, they say
there's nothing to worry about.
Yeah, they say there's nothing to worry about, but... So this report was done by the IARC, the Agency for Research on Cancer, which is an arm of the World Health Organization, and they put cell phones into the 2B category, which is a possible carcinogen. So a possible carcinogen is not a probable carcinogen, and the most important part about what happened recently and where the propaganda comes in, something we like to cover a lot, how the mainstream media... uses propaganda to try to manipulate public opinion. And the mainstream media mocked the classification of 2B, saying that it was in the category with coffee, car exhaust, pickles, and that's as if to implicate
minimize
and minimize the danger. Now, the problem there is that they're not explaining why it was put in the 2B category. It was put in the 2B category not because of a lack of danger, but because of a lack of data. The lack of data comes from the lack of recognized studies, or studies that they will say are qualified. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean the studies haven't been done. They have been done, but they just don't accept them. So to say that this is not dangerous because we don't have enough data is like saying, I think shooting someone in the head would kill them, but I don't want to try, so therefore I'll never know. So really, you got to look at it both ways to try to understand, look below the surface of the headlines. There's a lot more information there.
There's a professor, Hardell, from the Swedish doctor. He addressed the Royal Society, mm-hmm. And said that the people who started using mobile phones before the age of 20 had more than a five-fold increase in a certain type of cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know the propaganda machine is hard at work. CNN's Scott Woolley, he wrote about brain cancer rates decreasing in 2008 despite a 500% increase in usage in 10 years. Now, okay, Scott, that's pretty one-sided because most new users are children, and the effects take between 5 to 20 years for these to be
seen.
Well,
this is the problem. Yeah, cancer doesn't develop
overnight. It's not overnight. No, it's not like, you know, we don't use, seatbelts, so despite more people driving, more people aren't dying. You know, you can't equate the two. It takes time for it to happen.
But the people who are ringing the alarm are not marginal people. This is from the University of Pittsburgh. The head of the Cancer Research Institute there sent a memo to all of his employees urging them to limit their cell phone use because of the possible risk of cancer.
Hey, look, I've seen the studies that show the imagery, the brain imagery of when a child puts a cell phone up to his head.
Well, what do you say?
And you can see that the ring of influence goes from ear to ear. So when you hold the phone up to your right ear, you can see in a child's head that the influence of that radiation reaches to the other side of the head.
And it's actually heating your
brain. It's superheating your cells. It's a little microwave transmitter. It's reaching to a tower miles away. Yes, it's radiating your head. In an adult, because our skulls are more developed, and you have more muscle tissue, more denser skin, denser bones, you are able to withstand that radiation more. So it doesn't affect you quite as much. But the precautions that you should take are holding the phone away from your ear. Don't press it into your head.
So even holding it half an inch away?
Half an inch, 1 inch away, not making that contact with your head is going to make a big difference. Use the speakerphone, text message, use a hands-free, use a headset, even a Bluetooth, which, Bluetooth headset is not my favorite use because it's using radio frequencies to transmit from your earpiece to the phone, but the radio frequencies are not as bad as the microwave frequencies. Not nearly.
The reports also mention a danger of as for regarding cordless phones, which are very common in houses, which I thought was probably pretty safe because you're just communicating a short distance.
Yeah, they're using those radio frequencies as well, but it's at a, you know, it's from the 4 to 8 gigahertz range. You know, the modern phones are really getting up there in strength. So it's at least quadruple what it was 5-6 years ago. When you could buy a 1-2 gigahertz phone. And I really just don't think that these are necessary.
I wonder if we're seeing sort of a replay of the situation with cigarettes and cancer, where for years the government dragged its feet on the dangers of cancer because of the power of the tobacco lobby.
Yeah, but the telecoms, they are powerful.
It's incredibly.
I mean, look, right after this report came out, there was a report from... A English and Swedish group, a British and Swedish group, and they released a report stating exactly the opposite, and that was led by Anthony Swerdlow of Britain's Institute of Cancer Research. He was basically saying, no, there's no evidence. The fact that the World Health Organization said that it's a possible cause of cancer is short-sighted and not necessary. And he's basing his information on these old studies. And the most recent one is the Interphone study that was conducted in or released in 2010, but it was conducted from 1999 to 2004. So that's using really old phones that are not even like what we have now with our BlackBerries, iPhones, Droids, you know, which are transmitting data all the time and they're on all the time and they're so much stronger. So to say that, you know, you're comparing apples and oranges.
Well, it goes back to the problem we have in our society, our government, which is really controlled by large corporations, is how do you protect the welfare of people when the people who control your government obviously have a financial interest in not helping you? They're making profits, perhaps, from something that's unsafe for you.
Yeah. And, you know, for these dangerous effects to be felt, I think the most telling thing is that you only have to be using your phone for 15 minutes a day.
And that starts to have a bad effect.
And it will increase your chances from there.
It's really caused me to rethink it. I must say that the World Health Organization's affiliate has done a great service, and I'm glad the media
is it's not strong enough, but they did take a step.
It certainly heightened my awareness of it. I'm going to be more careful about my cell phone use and about my cordless phone use. I may actually go back to the old style telephone.
The old wire and a tin can.
Put that on my... Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, it's tough on long distance. I get hoarse quickly. I think we're coming probably to the end of our
time. Oh, wait.
Let me
add one more thing. The last most important thing that I found was the difference between GSM technology and CDMA. Verizon is a carrier that uses GSM technology, and that's a lower radiation because it's a consistent signal.
Yes.
So if you were to hold a radiation detector up to the phone, it would be a constant white noise sound. But if you're using a carrier like AT&T or T-Mobile, they're using what's called CDMA, and that is a pulsing technology. And there are some evidences where for medicinal purposes, when you use radio frequency treatments like the Rife machine, we've talked about that for cancer treatment. Sure. You can set that to pulse, and the pulse will become more powerful for killing microbials in your body for bacterial infections. You could kill them faster because when cells are exposed to a steady signal, they will actually recoil against it and defend themselves. But when it's a pulse, it actually overrides the defenses of your cells.
It destroys them.
So it destroys them quicker. So if you're pulsing your head with microwaves, you're actually increasing your chances of getting cancer.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it. You've been listening to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs show, and you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. We want to thank Dave Schwartz for...
Thank you very much, Dave.
...for hosting the show and for handling the engineering.
All right, now we will talk to you next time. You can remember, you can find our blog at... incontextreport.com.
And we will be on next Wednesday talking about the Goldenberg Group. That's at 6:30 on Wednesday.
All right, take care, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Fill up their heads with